Welcome to FemTech at Work, the podcast where we explore the intersection of technology, health, and women's empowerment in the workplace. Hosted by me, Maaike Steinebach. This show will dive into the innovative solutions transforming women's health and well-being in the workplace. Join us as we chat with FemTech founders, industry leaders, and change makers who are pioneering advancements in FemTech and women's health. We discuss everything: menstrual health, reproductive rights, menopause, but also the challenges women face in the workplace and how innovation can overcome them. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting your FemTech journey, FemTech at Work is here to inspire and inform you about the future of health and wellness for women everywhere. Tune in and be part of the conversation. Hi, and good morning, and welcome to this episode of the podcast FemTech at Work with today very special guests. I have two guests today, all the way from Thailand. Now, the first guest is Pat Thitipathakul, who is the managing director. And my other guest is Pop Sachugranchai, who is an investment manager, both at Disrupt Health Impact Fund. Hi, ladies. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. We're very excited to be here.
Yes. Have you been on a podcast before?
A few times, but okay. I mostly speak about startups and investment. So this time, getting invited to talk about FemTech, it's really exciting for me.
And I'm also excited for you because you are a relatively new, fresh fund. I'm very excited to hear a little bit more about it. So Pat, do you want to kick it off? Do you want to tell me a little bit about your background?
I've actually been in the VC space for almost 7 years now.
Wow.
In the past, we mostly invested in early stage startups. We were sector agnostic, investing in everything from fintech to e-commerce to logistics solutions, those kind of things. And I think it's quite interesting to invest in a company and then see how the company grows over years. Some survive, some didn't, but all provides very good lessons for both the founders and us as investors as well. What's exciting is that last year, because we got funded by a hospital and also other companies that were interested in healthcare. So for the first time ever, we launched a sector-specific fund. So it's called Disrupt Health Impact Fund. And with that fund, the mandate is to invest in health tech solutions. And in the past, we only make investments in Southeast Asia, Asia. But for the first time ever, again, we are investing globally. With this new fund, there's also a lot of learning opportunities for me as well, even though I've been working in a VC fund for quite a long time. This is something new to me and it's very interesting. I think healthcare is a sector that is quite attractive, but at the same time, it has its own challenges. I can say that I got into healthcare last year and became very interested, and it's so close to us. I mean, when we talk about healthcare, you're talking about someone's life, or your parents' life, or even for each and every segment of user, you can create some real impact on someone's life with technology. So I think that's what's beautiful about healthcare, even though it's difficult, but I also think that it's quite meaningful to be driving innovation in healthcare.
Yes. Hold that thought about why it's difficult, because I want to hear a little bit more about that. But I'm very excited that you started a fund focused on healthcare, because as you said, this is very close to everybody's heart, right? And what is also very interesting is that there are a lot of problems, particularly also around women's health, but increasingly we are seeing companies that are creating solutions for these problems, which is very, very exciting. But the big problem is everybody needs money. That's why it's great to hear there are funds like you that are not just focusing on Southeast Asia, but looking at a wider mandate. But before we continue, Pop, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up at a VC firm?
I am the investment manager of this fund. So basically help supporting from the fundraising of the fund to the investment due diligence and evaluation, prep the information to talk with our investment committees. And my background is from the technology side and also the finance by degree. Previously, I was working at Microsoft and focused on like the SaaS and involved with some healthcare project. And I actually always loved like them and very keen into like the entrepreneurship and also like the innovation side. I even start my small project 5 years ago in a pet sector area. And when I look into a different market, there are some booming sector in the energy, healthcare, and also the fintech, right? But healthcare caught my eye because what I love is not just a part of the making good return, we can also save the people's lives as well. after the COVID-19, people getting more aware of their healthcare and their wellness. So we see a huge upside on this. And we have seen not have a drive, a huge adoption yet. Hasn't you like much technology? So we see a huge chance of the AI and the remote health tools or like the prevention tools that can really help the patients in the area. So that's why I choose and join the Disrupt Health Impact Fund.
Amazing. Okay. Also a lot of things I want to unpack there. But Pat, let's go back to you and talk a little bit about the fund, because you mentioned that the fund came about because you also had a hospital group and other investors that were interested. What was the rationale, let's say, for a hospital group to set up a fund? Is that common in Thailand?
I would say that it's not common at all in Thailand and also some other countries. When we introduce our fund, we get all kinds of reaction. I think the hospital that we work with, Samitivet Hospital, is very progressive and the management is very forward-thinking. They set up an innovation team long time ago. They understand that some technologies they can develop themselves, but then sometimes it's better to work with partners on things that they don't really have technology expertise on. And then they've been running a lot of projects, and a lot of hospitals would focus on treatment and sick care, right? But for Samitivet, they have a strategy to expand into self-care and preventive care. They even launch a slogan that says, "We don't want anyone to get sick." It's kind of like controversial, right? You're running a hospital, but you say that you don't want anyone to get sick. And then they want to provide tools and technologies and ways to help people remain healthy. It's not about coming to hospital only when you get sick, but actually you're developing relationship with your healthcare professionals, and then they can give you advice on other stuff. Because actually, when we talk about wellness, you may think of spa or beauty, but actually it's all about well-being. So everything you do in your daily life kind of impact your health in the long term. Everything you eat or how you sleep, how often you exercise, those little things that you do in daily life would eventually impact your health. I think that everyone can imagine, like, every time you go to a hospital for a health checkup and you would discover something and you would feel surprised, but you've actually been building that up for a really long time. But we're just thinking that, is there any way that we can help people monitor their own health, not having to wait 6 months or a year to get reality check, but maybe you can do it more often with these day people wearing a lot of wearables. I think it's getting popular. And then on the hospital side, we're also thinking about how we can use this data to make healthcare more meaningful, more actionable. When we talk to doctors, a lot of times they would also say things like, oh, they have a consultation session, they make some recommendations. For example, I think the simplest one would be like, oh, you should stop eating too much fat or maybe less sugar. But in reality, it's not that easy to apply, and then it's hard for people to change behavior. That's how we think about digital health and these medical devices. If there's any way to help people actually change their behavior so that in the long run they would become healthier, this is our focus.
Amazing and super progressive, because I agree with you, not a lot of people are focusing on prevention whilst actually that is the way to go, but it will impact a lot of industries, right? It means if nobody gets sick, hospitals have no business, insurers have no business, pharma has no business. But obviously the reality is that we won't be able to prevent everything from happening, but just creating tools where people can have a healthier and better lifestyle that is more integrated with their healthcare providers and their insurance needs, by the way, I think is super, super powerful. Maybe I ask Paul, but have you already invested? How big is the fund? And have you already invested in any companies? And what have you invested in, if you're able to share?
So far, we made two investments. The first one, we invest in the non-invasive glucose monitoring. As you see, like, people, especially for people with diabetes type 1, they need to like have a finger prick to need to draw the blood from the finger, right? And they need to do that every day. So it's very painful. This one is kind of the pocket with the iPhone size, and they use the quantum cascade laser, the light that can, like, people just need to press their finger and wait for 20 seconds, and they can measure your blood sugar level, and they connect with the application so you can have a monitoring tools at your home. And this one, they help get Moonshot to be miniaturized, the sensor to be used in the smartwatch as well. They have some backer, for example, like the Samsung Ventures. I cannot say they have a potential collaboration with this, but we finger crossed with this. And that's the first one. It's a German company. So they have like a very strong research, around 15 years of the research backed by the University at Goethe. And the scientific team is very strong back out in this area. And the founder himself, they have your track record. So they already exit the three companies previously. And that's the first company. And the second one, we invest in the gut microbiome solution area. Basically, it's a platform that gathers the data from the gut microbiome testing. And they use the AI model to train and do the digital twins to adjust the behavior of the patients, to adjust healthy eating lifestyle and the food and the nutrition. And the key core technology of this solution is they can digest more than 200,000 of the research and publication, and they can categorize which of the research have been very well established and which one is emerging. So in order to validate and getting trust from the patient, the back of the research, the reference. This one, the continuity is very interesting. They have a potential collaboration and partnership in the big name of the longevity centers in the US, and the founder have a very track record as well. That's the two companies that we just invest this year.
Exciting. I think gut health is so incredibly overlooked and is going to be one of the big areas of growth going forward, particularly also for women, by the way. Pat, I know we met at the Femtech Connect conference in Singapore a few years ago. And I know both you and Pope are quite excited about women's health as well. Obviously, you currently haven't invested yet in a particular women's health or femtech company, but is this something you're looking at or interested in?
Absolutely. We've been looking at femtech companies. So actually, learning more about femtech, it's very eye-opening for me. I know that there are some issues that women have, and then they've not been solved yet. Good to know that there are some innovators who are trying to solve that. And then there are conversations around femtech, and it's much more complicated than I expected. And then I just realized that there are a lot of shocking facts that I just learned. For example, like when we talk about health or some kind of research data, and then it was revealed that participants in those kind of research, majority of them are done on white men, for example. So it might not really be applicable for you, unfortunately. So even myself, I do a lot of intermittent fasting. And then I just also learned that these data are also gathered from men. And then with women, when you do fasting, it also impacts your hormones. So you might have to do it differently. And I'm like, oh, really? I didn't know that. That's just an example of topic. But then there are so many other areas that it's underfunded and also under research. What happens is that you do a study and then you generalize it across groups. But women's body is so complicated. And to be fair, it's something that I also just learned last year too. It seems like public awareness isn't as high yet as well, which is very surprising to me. So at first, when we talk about femtech, I would think about things like, you know, menstrual cycle, menopause, all kinds of solutions that you will see, or like beauty solutions. But actually, it's go way deeper than that. We're developing our thesis around femtech, and we're seeing a lot of opportunities to do things related to women. It's kind of hard to say what femtech should mean. I think everyone has their own definition, but for us, whatever solutions that benefit women's health would fit our thesis. And then we also would like to support women's founder as well. From the investment side of things, I thought that when you present a business, it should be straightforward, right? If you have good company, good solution, good traction, then you should be able to get funding. But a lot of times, this is something new that I learned from my experience as well, that when I look at a femtech solution and when my colleagues that are men look at the femtech solution, we have very different first impression.
Exactly. Yeah,
every time, if I want to push for investment in those companies, and I have to do quite a lot of education on team members that are male, for example, because that's also something that I just learned over time as well. To answer your question, we're still very interested in femtech, but we've been speaking to quite a lot of companies and trying to form our thesis around that. But as I mentioned earlier, femtech is harder than I expected. So it's not only the solution itself, but also the way that you drive adoption. And there's also some confusion in some space. You have to also do public education sometimes. For example, like when you talk about menopause, some women are not really aware what they're going through or what they should actually do. So not just if you have a good solution, but then people don't know about it or people don't even realize that they are having this problem.
That they have this problem, yes.
Yeah, that makes it very complex in my opinion. So we would like to see how this goes.
Yeah.
And when the timing is right and we find the right solution, we really want to invest in femtech. And if it's founded by a women founder, I think it will be even greater.
Yeah. But it's amazing because that is exactly why I have this podcast. And because what I do is to just create more awareness, firstly, about all the founders that are in this space, both men and women, but also to your point that femtech is not just around reproductive health and it's not just about digital health, but it's actually digital health, medtech, and biotech. It basically covers the whole range from B2B to C and also has really gone beyond reproductive health to conditions that disproportionately affect women. And this is, as you now rightfully pointed out, we are learning more and more. So this is autoimmune, this is brain health, this is gut health, this is bone health, this is heart health, this is mental health, right? We now know that women are 2 times more prone to depression and mental health issues than men. I love the fact that you're saying as long as it's a solution for women's health, then we will look at it. But I also agree with the challenges that you mentioned, because I do think investors are part of the puzzle that we need to solve. And it's hard for men to relate to some of these problems. But what I have experienced over the last 2 years is that I thought I only had to educate the corporates and the insurers and maybe the investors. But actually, I also have to educate the women, because a lot of women are just not aware of their own health issues or problems. And it's basically, we need to educate the women. We need to educate the industry. So the corporates, the insurers that are users of these products, the government. That, I think, makes it all a bit harder than, let's say, more generic healthcare. Thank you so much for at least making the effort to go and explore this industry to see what you can do. When we started off this conversation, you mentioned that healthcare in general is challenging. Why do you feel healthcare in general is challenging to invest in?
Yeah, because with our experience, when you invest in solutions like fintech or e-commerce, for example, you get traction very quickly and it kind of like scale up very fast. Sometimes company grows so much over the 3 to 5 years, you would always see commercial growth. But with health tech, you kind of have to be patient sometimes, because I think it has pros and cons. When we talk about health tech, I would split them into 2 categories just for simplicity. So first would be deep tech companies. Some patented technologies need time to do more R&D, need to do studies on patients, need to validate and get feedback from doctors, hospital, nurses, you name it. As you can see, the process of them developing the solution isn't easy at all. But then once you have the solution, then you have to go through regulatory approval. And then once you have that, you have to go to market. And then you still have to figure out how would you scale adoption across hospitals, for example. That's also something very difficult, comparing to, say, you have a software, you launch it, maybe you get millions downloads tomorrow, but it's very hard for that to happen for these kind of companies. But what's exciting about them is that sometimes they really develop technologies that can actually groundbreaking. It improves the quality of care and it does things that never in the past has been done before. We also see the potential of these groundbreaking technology, but with deep tech investment, you may have to wait a long time until you see commercial results. But as long as we believe on their scientific evidence, we still want to make this kind of investment, because I also think that it's necessary and digital platform cannot solve everything. Sometimes you need really deep technology, especially in healthcare. And then the second category would be digital health, for example, which can be more scalable. But then if you compare how you scale an e-commerce business with how you scale digital health, it's still totally different stories. And I also learned that convincing user to adopt something for convenience or entertainment is far easier than convincing doctor to adopt something. And it's not because they don't want to adopt technology, but because they have so much responsibility. And then they have to consider patient safety, for example, or like effectiveness or whatever claims you make, it has to make sense to them. And then other than that, it also has to fit into clinical workflow, for example. So even for digital health company, you still have to think a lot about how you would drive adoption and then how you would scale it. So I would say that it's not easy at all. And then there are things around reimbursement as well. Are you able to get any reimbursement code to make it more accessible across the country, for example? Or how do you scale to another country? Is there any regulatory approval that's different from your current market? There are a lot of things that you have to think about, and also patient outcomes, of course. Like if you're delivering your digital therapeutics visually, and then can you prove that it's effective enough, or like creating enough patient outcomes to keep people using, or if you want insurers to pay for it, then what are the values that you're creating? Yeah, you need a lot of data, and I don't think it's easy at all. But again, another thing is that if you could crack it, then you would be a market leader for quite some time, because it's not easy. I mean, if you run any other platform or applications, someone could actually copy your idea, right? But then for this, even though they can copy the idea, but then going to market isn't easy at all, and it takes time, and you need to build trust, you need to show results. I think it's a very complicated market.
Yes, but I think the good news is that globally, health is having its moment, I feel. If you look at the data around the increase in investment, both in health and women's health as well, it's clearly an upward trend, despite all the challenges that are happening, which I think is good. So I think if we all move together at one point, there will be a tipping point on adoption, and there will be a tipping point where people are like, oh, hey, this is actually important. Maybe I can ask Pop. And I know both of you were actually just also in Europe to attend a lot of the different conferences that were there. Pop, what makes a company stand out for you? So when you select startups for investment, what are the three things that you look out for?
My answer would be very simple. So the first one would be like the pain point, right? The fundamental part. So it's a real pain point, and that solution is a right fit with this pain point. With our process, we kind of talk with our advisor and our doctor advisor, the clinician side, quite a lot, because sometimes we see the product is very good, but the clinician doesn't like want to use or want to adopt it. So it's very important because they are very kind of play the critical role in terms of to drive the adoption from the patient side, because they are the one who do the prescription and they need to do the recommendation to the customer or the patient, right? That's the first one. And the second one would be the team. The base or the ideal case would be they need to have the founding team from the two sides. So the first side would be on the scientific part. They can be like a scientist, a researcher who built or invent the core technology. And they need to like pair it up with the business person that can build and scale the operation and also do the commercialization and can sell the company at the end. Yeah. That's the second one. And I think the last one would be on the core technology part. So the data proprietary and also the core technology that they can expand or scale into other use cases to broaden the market landscape. For example, they can start with the asthma use cases, and they can also explore the COPD or the epilepsy. It's very depend on the case by case, but they have a very strong fundamental. So at the end, they can do the scalability side of things.
Amazing. To both of you, when you were in Europe, was there any particular area that you were like, oh my God, this is so exciting that people were talking about?
I think a lot of people are talking about AI, and that's no surprise at all. But I want to be more specific on how applying AI in healthcare can create a lot of impacts. First would be around labor shortage. We all know that it's not easy. In some countries, you get access to healthcare. Doctors are always busy. And then having AI assistant can help address this problem. It sounds simple, but I think it's not easy at all. But I think it's something that can help the hospital quite a lot. And then the second thing is how can make access to healthcare more scalable. So for example, if you can triage patients and you can actually know who have to come in and who don't really need to come in. And then for some kind of treatment, maybe it can be done at home, or diagnostic that can be done at home, but then having AI would make it more accessible for everyone. I think it would still take some time for adoption to really happen at mass scale, but then there are also some early traction right there. And then From the patient's perspective, I think it's quite impactful because imagine that you cannot get any appointment and you have to wait another month just to see your GP. Having in between while you're waiting, at least if you can interact with AI, it's still better than not having anything at all, right? And then AI cannot give you medical recommendations, of course, but then sometimes you just need some kind of guidance.
Yeah, amazing. And Pope, was there anything for you that stood out?
For me, I would say on the mental health area, it's kind of like the huge pain point, right? It's very hard to solve. And I feel like with the current solutions for the mental health, it's very subjective. And with the current solution, the patient need to like remembering and report on how they feel. They need to input the information to the application, which sometimes cannot be reliable. And with the session, when they need to consult with the therapist, they often happen only a weekly. And there are like some in transit over the week that they have a change in their mood or their emotion, but it's very hard to capture all of the information. So far as I found, there are the new biomarker that can like passive monitoring on this area. So I think this one is very interesting. For example, we found a voice biomarker. It's a new indicator, but I mean, to be honest, into adopt practically, they need to be involved into other indicators as well. And we have found some digital phenotyping, like the usage of their phone or the pattern on how to use the social media, on how the people scrolling their phone. So it can help to detect anxiety and depression, but it cannot stand alone indicator. They need to involve with other indicator to measure comprehensively as well. If the company can gather the data proprietary very strong, I think it could be a very potential in this area. And I saw some companies in Europe is trying to build this.
That's super exciting. When you compare, let's say, some of the startups in Asia or Southeast Asia and Europe and the US, do you see any key differences, Pat, maybe for you?
Yeah, because the local context is very different. Even if you develop same kinds of solutions, for example, telemedicine, the way you go to market is still quite different in each country. And it also depends on what the context. For example, just in Southeast Asia, it's already different. Like you launching something in Thailand versus something in Indonesia. When we evaluate companies from these, for example, three regions, we see some differences and similarities. But we also learned that some startups in Europe actually want to expand to the US, because like if you have to expand within Europe, then I guess it's the same story for Southeast Asia, where you go to another country, then you have to do a lot of localization. But if you go to the US and you do that one time and you get access to such a big market, but then it's also very competitive in the US. I would say that everyone comes to the US. So you're not only competing locally, but you're kind of like competing with everyone else in the world, kind of want to enter your market. I would say, of course, for investors, I guess US is the most interesting market in terms of commercialization opportunity. But then I think the beauty of healthcare is that there are some solutions that can be applied for populations from all around the world. There are people who have diabetes, for example, or like cardiac issues in almost every country. I guess what we are looking for is a global solution. That's what we have in mind. So, okay, even though you're from the US, Europe, or wherever, or in Asia, but if your solution can be applied to global population, I think that's the best case scenario for us. But if not, it's also understandable because like some countries have different problems, different ways to tackle it. So I think it really depends on the solution that we're looking at. I would say that in Europe, there are quite a lot of early stage deep tech companies, a lot of diagnostic companies as well. In the US, we find almost everything because the number of companies are so high, and then we have to be careful when we do the selection. Every time when someone pitch something related to AI, and then we have to be mindful about the accuracy level that they claim, because everyone would pick the best number, right? But then we have to look deeper into how did they arrive at this conclusion? How's the validation being done? Things like that. And in Asia, I think it's also quite interesting. We start seeing more companies in Asia expanding to elsewhere. I guess for us, we look at every country.
You look at everything.
Yeah, so it depends on the category. Say if we're looking at a diagnostic solution for women, then we have to look at every market and see if there's anything interesting, if there's anyone developing something unique, for example. And then if it's unique, does it only apply to Asian population or it can actually be applied globally?
I think it's interesting because Indonesia has the same amount of inhabitants as the US, right? But the profile and the spending power is very different. Access to medical care, affordability are become major, major differences. Same like India and Japan, for example. Maybe Pope, for you, what are you seeing at the moment are some of the common challenges that founders are encountering these days?
Same with Pat, as mentioned earlier. First one would be on getting government approval, getting FDA approval or approval based on like countries by country. Some company, they burn the cash in a year in order to get this. But we also found that with some founders, they try to adjust or tackle with this challenge by adjusting the use case of the product to be the wellness case and sales for the wellness product first while pending for the approval. So with this, they can taste the market, getting some feedback from the customer as well. It's kind of like a good strategy for this. And the second one would be on the slow sales cycle, especially for like the B2B in the healthcare area. When they need to sell to the healthcare provider or when the hospital, sometimes it takes in a year, starting from piloting, do the demo, trying, tasting, rolling out, right? And they need to approve, getting trust from the doctor as well. Sometimes the company cannot running out of cash or having the issues in terms of like the cash management. And the last one, I would say that there are a lot of the competitions, especially for the variables, they complete each other by adding more parameters that they can detect. But sometimes there has an issue because the clinician don't buy it. Some parameter don't have adding much clinical value on this. They need to focus on the fundamental pathway, not just the adding parameters, but also like in terms of the holistic integration and the journey.
I'm nodding for everything that you're saying because I hear it daily. I think we're almost at the end of this podcast. Maybe just a closing question to both of you. Pat, when you talk about femtech and women's health, what are you most excited about?
Currently, I'm actually most excited about diagnostic solution. I also think that there are taboos around that sometimes, like for some kind of disease, for example, and then when there's taboo around that, then you're afraid to go see doctor, or even if you go see doctor, then you're afraid that someone might see you there. It's not only diagnosing something, but it's also like helping someone get access to that and not feeling shameful about that. It's something that's quite interesting. So I also just learned that a lot of disease can be prevented, or like we're under screen, even though the government sometimes provide the service for free, but some people don't know about it, or even if they know about it, they still don't go for whatever reasons. I think if we can provide an alternative option that's user friendly, if they can do it at home and send it back to the lab, or if it's point of care, where I think there are so many ways to tackle that. And then I just feel like this is an area that sounds very straightforward, but turns out that a lot of people still don't have access to that. And then if we can support this kind of company and make healthcare screening more accessible, then women doesn't have to go through that journey alone.
I totally agree with you. If we can create options for women to choose how they want to be served when it comes to these health screenings, I think we are able to democratize the well-being of women in such a great way. And Pope, is there anything that excites you in women's health?
I'm keen on the early cancer detection for women health. For example, for the ovarian cancer, like breast cancer, right? For example, like for the ovarian cancer, if we can cause in the early state, the survival rate would be higher. For example, for the 5 year survival rate is over 90%. But when we detect late, it's going to be dropped around like 30%. Most of the current tools now, they can miss up to 70%. I came across Halo-G's, and it's very interesting. For example, like the liquid biopsy that can detect tumor DNA in blood before the imaging can show a tumor. Also, the AI power mammogram analysis, and also the at-home diagnostic devices that can analyze urine, saliva for the early biomarker for the early cancer detections. This innovation can hold a lot of potential to save millions of lives of people by taking the cancer early, and they have still highly treatable rate.
Amazing. Well, I'm as excited as you are about all this stuff. Pat and Pope, thank you so much for being on my podcast today. If you enjoyed this podcast, please and share it, because then we can give a greater voice to women's health and femtech innovation in Asia. Thank you, Pat, Pope, for joining me today here, and all the best of luck with your fund. Thank you.